Coming up in this interview, did today's guest say that the lowest point was selling his company to Twitter after 9 months? Wait till you hear why. Also, how do you find the perfect business or product idea for you? Maybe the way that today's guest had Thursday meetings with his co-founder is the right approach for you. Also, did you know that there's a danger in making your product too easy to use? Don't miss that part of this interview. All that and so much more coming up. Catch it. Listen up. I hate to have commercials interrupt this interview, so I'm going to tell you about three sponsors quickly now, and then we're going to go right into the program, starting with Walker Corporate Law. If you need a lawyer who understands the startup world and the tech community, I want you to go to walkercorporatelaw.com. Next, I want to tell you about Shopify. When your friend asks you, how can I sell something online? I want you to send them to Shopify and explain to them that Shopify stores are easy to set up, they increase sales, and they'll make your friend's products look great. Shopify. Finally, I want to tell you about Grasshopper. Do you want a phone number that people can call and then press 1 for sales, 2 for tech support, etc., and have all of the calls be routed to the right person's cell phone? Well, get your number from grasshopper.com. All right, let's get started. Hey there, freedom fighters. My name is Andrew Warner, and I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. How excited would you be if you sold your company? Today's guest says it was more of a mixed blessing for him. Luke Robluski co-founded BagCheck, which helped people share lists of the gear that they used. And today, he runs the Input Factory, which released its first iOS app, Polar. I invited him to talk about the launch and sale of his previous company, BagCheck, and also I want to find out about what he's up to at the Input Factory. Luke, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
To launch BagCheck, you and your co-founder talked every Thursday. What'd you guys talk about?
Yeah, so we started out, basically what we did is we used to work at Yahoo together. And what we do in the after hours, one day a week, we would get together at a mutual friend's office, sit around a whiteboard and talk for 2 to 4 hours about things that we were interested, ideas we had had previously, generate ideas together, and really just try and make the process of what we wanted to work on together very collaborative. Right. The way that company started, the genesis of it was I wanted to work with Sam and Sam wanted to work with me. So we said, hey, let's do something together. But what we were going to create and how we were going to go about doing it, that was all to be determined.
Why do you want to work with Sam? What was it about him?
So actually, that's an interesting story. When I was at Yahoo, there was a very large division called the Consumer Products Group, which was basically everything that hit the individual outside of like sales and ad networks and things like this. So anyone that was a human that went to Yahoo to use like Mail or FrontPage, that was included in there. Okay. And so this consumer network thing spanned a lot of products. And what they had was every single week they would have a 6-hour long meeting where they would go and review the strategy, the implementation of each product, and each team would sort of roll in there. And I sat in on those meetings as sort of the design representative to make sure we had a good user experience across the board. And Sam sat in as sort of the technology representative, sort of the mini CTO of that world, if you will. And during all these meetings, we saw every single product come in. We saw all these guys talking about it. And we realized we really had a very common sense of, I don't want to say critique, but the things we both saw and brought up as points, we were very aligned on. So I think that made us both interested in working together because, like, hey, we really see the same things, care about the same issues, and think about things in the same way. It was sad that we learned that through, you know, 6 hours of PowerPoint presentations every week, but that was kind of how we got together.
In fact, you told Jeremy, who pre-interviewed you, I took over the design team in charge of the Yahoo homepage design. It was a year that felt like being stung by bees. Why is that?
Yeah. Well, if anybody out there has ever worked on a homepage redesign, you know what it's like. That is, everybody wants their link on the homepage. Everybody needs their space on the homepage. And imagine doing that for what at the time was the largest homepage on the web, period, right? I mean, Yahoo back in those days was like 15% of online time. Obviously, things have changed these days. But back then, you know, Yahoo was the internet for a lot of people. And when you have a company that has tens of thousands of employees, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of products, and they all want to be on the homepage, it's sort of like the homepage redesign problem magnified to the largest scale humanly possible. So there's lots of great things about that process, but then there was also an awful lot of, hey, I need this thing. Hey, I need that thing. Hey, I need that. And that's
Can you give
hence
me an
the thousand
example of an
bees.
absurd request that you had to still follow through on because this was Yahoo?
Yeah, I always love this. When I was at eBay, we did there was a project for the redesign of registration, and someone on the team came up with this phrase. I believe it was, can't remember exactly who did it now, but the phrase was, "No one raindrop believes they're to be bl to blame for the flood." And what it re represented was the eBay registration process had, the marketing team wanted to ask the demographics of somebody registering. The privacy team needed them to agree to these terms and services. The legal team needed them to, verify they were this and this age or something like that. And on the surface, each one of those people's requests seemed totally reasonable, especially from their point of view, right? Like, of course, marketing wants to know that. Yes, the legal team is totally in the right trying to ask for it. But when you add it all up, it turns into this giant form of 50 questions that nobody ever gets through, and they drop off and don't join eBay. So it's the same thing that was going on with the front page, right? No one in particular was necessarily to blame, but when you add up like the small business unit and the podcast website and the video website and the search website and every single product that Yahoo had competing for that precious real estate, you run into the same problem of it's a flood.
As an
And that
outsider,
was, of
what would you
course, the
do
issue.
about that?
I think you have to take a very hard stance on what's really driving the business and what's not. So I did a very interesting exercise when I was there, which ultimately didn't get any traction, but for me was, I thought it was a really compelling way of looking at it. I took the click-through data on the homepage, on the Yahoo homepage, and I mapped it out percentage basis, like what percent of clicks go to what link. And I did a redesign where I allocated that percent of pixel space to that product on the homepage. All right, so let's say, for example, this is sort of like I'm faking out the numbers, but let's say 40% of links go to mail or something like that. So 40% of that screen space was dedicated to mail and your inbox and your links. And it was a really interesting way of looking at like what actually matters to people on Yahoo and what are they going and doing and interacting with.
I see.
Now, click-through rates are only part of the story, right? Because you also have to see which one of those links actually leads to money. And I think that's wherein a lot of these things get hung up because the message often is, let's rethink the design and come up with something totally revolutionary, but don't move any of my numbers. Don't change the status quo in any way, shape, or form. Which is kind of like being asked to, completely renovate a house, but never move any of the furniture. It's
Which
just
I can
hard
see
to,
why you
right?
and Sam would want to go and start your own company. And there you were, getting together regularly to talk about different ideas. What was your process for finding the right business idea?
Well, we started out with very concrete ideas, but what we gradually made our way toward was looking at a bigger picture trend. So, like actually markets, right? So we started with like, oh, I got this specific idea for this. I have this specific idea for that. And over time, what we found was, okay, this related space is actually the thing that we want to focus on. And for us at the time, one of the big ahas that kind of went off in our head was when you looked at what had happened with e-commerce. The top, like if you look at the top 15 websites in the world and you look globally, right? Top 15 websites over the past 10 to 12 years, over half the list of the top websites had changed. But if you went and looked at the top list of the e-commerce websites on the web over the past 15 years, well, none of them had changed. So maybe only one had moved into list and everything else actually stayed the same. And even the rankings
I see.
mostly stayed the same. And at that point, the light bulb went off and we're like, wow, so much stuff has changed on the web, but e-commerce has just sort of stayed like this, right? So there's going to be something here and it's really interesting. And so that was kind of where we netted out with the focus. Like, let's go into this market, let's look at this area, and rather than trying to do anything, everything, let's use it as a focal point.
Okay. And now even e-commerce though is pretty broad. It includes everything from eBay to Amazon to local stores. How do you figure out where you're going to be?
Yeah, so at that point, it was okay, here's the space we're playing with, and then let's really try and humanize it. And the thing that created sort of a human connection to things was, stuff that's in our day-to-day lives. And what we realized was if you're really into something, like let's say you're into mountain biking, which I am. So every time I go mountain biking with my buddies, we spend half the ride talking about, like, oh, why'd you get that seat? Did you try these shoes? Oh, my shoes aren't working so well. I think I need new brakes. Oh, which brakes should I get? And, like, half the interaction around having a hobby or a passion is around the gear you use for it. Same thing with photography. And even like if you're a computer nerd, you're talking about the mice you use, you're talking about the monitor you have, all this stuff, right? And so there's just this real world interaction going on around people talking about the gear to use the things that they do that they love. And this naturally leads to some e-commerce thing, right? So that was kind of the impetus for when we went with BagCheck. And that was what drove it to us. So very high level, right? Commerce, products, then very tangible, real world human behavior that we really didn't see happening online very concretely. Like there wasn't anything specifically that had taken that kind of behavior and made it digital.
And so the next step you took was to actually put together visuals of it. What software did you use to create your mock-up?
Actually, I used Keynote very early on with these things. So I have learned over the years that abstract deliverables tend to lead to abstract decisions. What I mean by that is if you give somebody like a wireframe of a couple gray boxes, I think it means X, you think it means B. You know, I see zebra in my head, you see a lion, and then we never agree when we get there. So like what I like to do in the early stages of thinking of things is to get as tangible as possible, because then you get very, very real feedback. Like people see the visuals, they see them moving, they see somebody actually interacting with it. And all of a sudden they have very concrete feedback and there's very little room for interpretation. Right? I thought you meant this. I thought you meant, no, well, here it is. It looks just like a product and it's actually moving.
And the reason it's moving is Keynote allows you to kind of fake interaction. When people click on one slide, they think they're clicking on a button on a web page. And when they're led to another slide, they think they're led to another web page.
Yeah, it's actually, you can go deeper than that. Like I make Keynote that actually simulate like finger gestures and clicks. And so it looks like a finger's clicking on it, pages scroll, things
flip.
What
do you use to do that? Is that Keynotopia?
No, it's just Keynote.
Just so straight up Keynote, you just start designing because that's what you do.
Yeah, so Keynote has two features that make it really, or three features I think that make it really good for this kind of work. One is the canvas is a pixel-based canvas, so you can set it to actual screen sizes and it represents real screen sizes. Two, it has basic animation tools. There's not a timeline or anything like that, but it's enough for you to be able to simulate stuff. And three, it's narrative software, meaning it's sequential, right? It's a series of slides, which naturally forces you to think in terms of stories and flows and interactions instead of this flat picture, right? It's something has to come after it. What happens after that, right? So yeah, it works really, really well for those kinds of things. And it's fast. You can move, work in it really quickly.
And you took that out to people. And actually, what people did you pick to show it to?
Well, at the time, we were getting feedback from a number. So when we started this process, we were kind of still at Yahoo. We left Yahoo when we took EIR roles over at Benchmark Capital. So we were both entrepreneurs in residence in there. And at the time, we were talking to a lot of our friends in the industry, in the VC world, and sort of people we had worked with back and forth in the Valley. You know, not necessarily getting very concrete feedback from them, but more directional and high-level stuff. And a lot of that early feedback we got actually drove big picture strategic decisions that we made with the product. So anybody who'd care to listen. And we
can give an example of the kind of feedback you got when you showed someone a Keynote version of the site that you had in mind?
Yeah, well, one of the best pieces of feedback we got was actually from Reid Hoffman over at Greylock. And I sort of talked to him, showed him some of the things we were doing in Keynote. And I remember this still now because it sort of resonates with me. He said, you know, most people misinterpret what social interactions are about. Because we were talking about, you know, people interacting with each other, creating that content. So it's sort of a social product. And he said, you know, social, most people are interested in sort of showing off themselves, right? Like show their feather. Look at how cool I am. Check out my awesomeness. And then the other piece is they're trying to make connections with each other and build relationships. And like, that's it. So he kind of took those two things and really distilled it down into something very simple. And those two principles were kind of the bedrock of a lot of the things that we did with BagCheck.
I see. They want to show off the stuff that they own, their gear, and they want to interact with other people who have similar gear.
Yeah, show off the stuff that you have, you know, paint yourself as an expert in it, highlight, look, I've invested 20 years in making coffee. I know what the heck I'm doing, guys. Check this out. Right? Like you sort of want to get that out, right? It's an investment.
What about users? Did you show it to users who helped shape your vision of the business?
Yeah. We had a lot of early sort of prototyping and interaction with people, especially as people came on. We actually built a very interesting tool, which since then has sort of been productized. But what it was a real-time feed of all the activity happening on the site. So at any point in time, we could sort of flip the site backwards and see this person is here. They're on this page. They just clicked on this. They just typed this in, and you have a real-time stream of each person. And then you could click on one of those actions and actually see the site as they saw it. So it would sort of flip you into their view, and you could see, you know, the elements they saw, the things they were looking at, and we'd highlight the thing that you just clicked on the page. Which was,
How did that idea come about?
that was all Sam.
It was Sam thinking,
Yeah,
hey, we need this in order to understand what users are doing.
for a long, no, not even that. For a long time, he was like, I want to build this thing. I'm going to build this thing. And then one night, he just took a weekend and made it. And I was like, oh my God, this is
I can
amazing.
see how that'd be helpful. It's like looking over someone's shoulders, they're using your site, you watch where they get stuck, you watch where they keep interacting.
Yeah,
What
it was
about
actually addictive.
Sorry?
It was addictive. People on the team would get addicted to that feed because you'd just be watching it and there's always things changing and you're learning. So it was really, really useful.
What about when you showed the keynote presentation to a potential user? Did you hear something like, hey, I don't get this, where do I sign up? Did you hear anything that helped shape the product in those early conversations?
No, it wasn't that kind of
It
stuff,
wasn't.
right? That document was all around getting us aligned on what's the vision and what are we trying to make. It was nothing, there was no usability or any of that kind of feedback involved with that process, right? That came much later and deeper. It's a high-level concept piece that's very tangible and understandable, but it was, let's plant a flag over here that we're all marching towards versus let's get very specific with design elements
I
and
see. I
feedback.
thought you were going out there and saying, does this make sense? Do you want to use this? If you did use this, what would you do with it? You weren't even at that point. What you wanted to do was say, this is what we're all working for. Who's with me?
Yeah, I don't know if I believe in that kind of methodology of, you know, hey, do you want to use this? Because like, you get a lot of times you have to make it real for people and you have to make it part of their lives before they even understand whether or not they would use something.
Okay.
And you know, if you look at the history of lots of successful companies out there, the first reaction most people have is like, what is this for? You know, Twitter, I don't want to tell people I eat a sandwich, right? Instagram, somebody tells you about Instagram, like, why do I want to make my photos look crappy?
I see. And the only way that you can really get to see if they're interested in it is to put the product in front of them. And even when you do put the product in front of them, they may hate it at first and it takes some time. I
Well,
see.
this is why you try and build lightweight up front and you try and focus on the core things early on, so that you don't build something huge and complicated that nobody ever uses. You
So then
start to
how do you
make
know what the
this.
core thing is? I guess in your case, you talked to Reed and he helped you identify the core and you understood what you would have wanted and that helped you figure out the core.
Yeah, it's actually deeper than that, right? So the core idea, as I mentioned before, was like, let's take this behavior of people talking about and sharing their gear, and bring it online. And the way we actually iterated on that front is our whole first interface was a command line interface. So we didn't even have any graphical user interface or anything.
So you
And the way
created
we.
all of Keynote and you still went command line first.
No. So
Okay.
Keynote was like the vision. Here's where we're going to, right? Then we built a command line version that we actually started to interact with. So through the command line, literally, like typing in, we would be assembling lists and making things. And you could output it and see what you made in the command line. We did that for a long time. And then the first iteration where we actually made it visual, we made a mobile website. And the reason why we made a mobile website off that command line was because mobile is these tiny little screens and it's very constrained. So we had to figure out what's most important, how does it work. And the other thing that was really good about that process was because we had put it on the phone first, it was always with us. Meaning, like anywhere and everywhere, we could just pull out the phone, start interacting with it, show it to people, and think about how we would actually use it day to day, and would we?
That makes sense.
So yeah, that process, it took us like, you know, three iterations of the product before we ever created like a traditional quote unquote website,
I
which
see.
is interesting to me because most people start out by making a Photoshop mock-up of the website. Like that's the first thing you do. Okay, let's make a picture of the homepage. This is what we're building, right? And it took us like three iterations, four iterations if you count the keynote presentation before we ever got to that
What did you learn
stage.
from the command line interface that shaped the first designed version of the site?
Yeah, what actions you would take on each object, what properties each object should have, how the objects should be related to each other. So it's very fundamental to like the structure of the system.
Can you make it more concrete with a specific example?
Yeah, absolutely. So the metaphor that we created for the product, you've heard the name bag check over and over again. When we thought about like how are people going to wrap their heads around the gear that I use to do my things? And we stumbled across lots of photo groups on Flickr that were called like what's in my bag? And what would happen would photographers would spill out the contents of their photo bag, take a picture of it and annotate it. Mountain climber would spill out the contents of their gear bag, take a picture of it and annotate it. Very painful process, but they're obviously passionate enough about the stuff that they're doing it. So we thought there was something to this kind of metaphor. Maybe we could play off of it. Hence the idea of like, let's check out what's in your bag, right? Let's see what are you using for this gear. And so the high level object, the list of your stuff, we call the bag. And with the command line, you know, you could basically go in there and say, create new bag. Okay, well, what kind of attributes do we have for the bag? Oh, it should have a title. Should it have a category? Oh, yeah, because you probably want to characterize it this and this way. And then you add items. Well, what is that item called? What kind of attributes does it have? How does it, you know, interrelate to other objects? All that stuff gets figured out when you have this sort of raw bare bones command line interface, because you're looking at things very structurally independent of UI. And so you're thinking about relationships, you're thinking about actions you want to take on those objects and stuff like that.
One thing that you scraped by going through this pro or scrapped, I should say, by going through this process is updates of where people were using it.
Yeah.
Why?
So that was one of the other early ideas was, okay, well, bag check, right? Like check in too. Like I got my photo gear. I love taking photos. Everywhere I'm at, I'm like, oh, I'm using my thing over here. Look at what I'm creating. We ultimately scrapped that because when we had this mobile version that we carried around in our pockets, we realized like, why would I ever? I would never do this, right?
I might want a picture of my pedals to show that these are the pedals that I'm using and show them off, but I wouldn't want to show you where I took them and
But
check.
I'm not doing it every single time I'm riding my bike, right? Every single time I'm riding my bike, I'm not saying I'm riding my bike, I'm riding my bike. So that was a superfluous thing. And frankly, it was casting the net way too wide early on. Like we were just trying to do way too much. And that was kind of another big lesson I took away from the bag check work was really trying to focus things down even more than we had. Pretty important.
Okay, so now you've got a vision, you got a product, you've got to get some users. Where'd you get your first users?
Well, with bag check, we took a very conservative route, meaning we did not do anything to commercialize it. We didn't do any press. We didn't talk to anybody about it. What we did was we just sort of lightly started telling our friends about it, and I started posting some things on Twitter and stuff like that. So we pretty organically started growing the audience through our shared connections and the audiences we have in our industries. More than anything else. And that was strategic because we wanted people who were really web people and sort of deep into things. So it was a lot of kind of inviting, a lot of personal connections and stuff like that. But we didn't do any press or launch announcements or anything of that sort.
It's kind of a challenge though, because when you reach out to your friends, they get offers to try so many new things. And so many of their friends are tech people who want them to try new things. How do you get your friends' attention and get them to actually use this when all you did was tweet?
Hey, pull favors. No.
So you
I'm
reach
kidding.
out and you say, hey, can you do me a favor and do this?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I think what you want to do is have a core base that you know would actually get in there and try stuff, right? And so over the years, I've met many, many, many people. And I do have set people that I know are kind of into this sort of thing and like to try early things and, you know, want to see what I've been doing or, you know, more personal relationships. So you leverage your more personal relationships early on. And then over time, you sort of extend it further and further. And, you know, our philosophy was like, we want to get the product really right before we ever go very large with it. And we ended up in a situation where we were trying to get the product righter, righter, and righter. And not really going bigger with it for a long time. And
What do you
ultimately, I
mean
think
by
that was
writer, writer,
true.
writer?
Like, we just kept fixing things we knew needed to get fixed, and we kept adding things we knew would make it better, and that
How
list
do you
ended
know
up
what
being
to
endless.
fix? What's your process for knowing what to fix?
Yeah. Us. A, dog food it. So just use the damn thing all the time. If you use your thing all the time, you will know really quickly what the pain points of it are, right? I think that is something that a lot of companies just don't do enough of, especially when you get into larger organizations and they're making things for other people. People never even use the product,
Maybe
right?
in
Like,
larger organizations, but I feel like in smaller organizations, the more they use it, the more it's like petting a dog. And the more you pet your dog, the more you love your dog as he is, and you accept him jumping up on your leg because, you know, now you pet him so much that you want him to come up on your leg and make it easier for you. And pretty
yeah.
soon, what you've got is a dog that jumps up on people, and you love the dog even more for doing that. So the same thing, taking it back to software, I found that people who use their own software a lot, they get so into the mind of their software and they adjust things just for themselves that when I finally get in there, I have to get into their mind, into their way of thinking, and then I could understand the app. And even after that, it's just completely useless to me because I'm
Yep.
not them. How do you avoid that?
I think it matters on your perspective. Like all I see is flaws, right? So I don't see the dog jumping up on me and being happy. I say like, oh my God, the dog needs a haircut. Oh my God, the dog's fingernails are dirty. Oh my God, the dog's, ear is messed up. And that's what I see when I start using it.
But you know what? So I've got someone in mind here, and smart guy. I don't want to mention him specifically, but I feel like he's a typical person where he uses his product so much that he thinks that the solution is to be able to make his product easier to keep using, to keep creating with his product. And I am so confused by all the different things that you can keep creating that I'm overwhelmed. I don't even know where to start with it. I don't even know how to use it in my life. But he just keeps creating all these different things with it, and he loves it even. Basically, I'm saying when you use your own product, it becomes your product. When you get other, I imagine that if you get other people to use it and other people to signal what their problems are with it, that you then make a product that fits their lives better.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't get me wrong. I was not saying that's the only thing that drives what you're doing, right?
I didn't
But
think so.
like
So what I'm
as
trying to get at is how do you do it?
no.
What's your process? You like KissMetrics, where on the bottom of every one of their pages, Heat and Shop puts an input box asking for feedback. Are you like Noah Kagan, who on all of his pages, he tracks the hell out of you so that he can tell what you're doing? Are you like Ramit Sethi, who might send out surveys constantly to people? What was your process for getting that feedback?
Whatever and however,
Give me an
like
example
I'll
of
take
something
anything.
you
So
did.
I mean, I mentioned that tool we built, right? That tool we built was all about collecting as much feedback. So what we would do is we'd launch a new feature. Let's say we change the registration flow to include an additional step.
Okay.
So we change this registration flow. I'd do a tweet or like an email blast to X number of people. And what we do is watch them come in, see exactly what they're doing, see where they trip up, and start fixing things immediately.
How do you
If
know
we
where they
saw
trip up?
something,
What's an indication
because
that?
we see every single step they're doing. We're like, oh my gosh, 10 people cut off on this and this step. Or, hey, this isn't working because we're only getting six values here. Okay, let's try something different, throw a next set of people at it. If we saw something we didn't understand, we'd literally reach out to people and we'd contact them like, hey, we saw you got our admin system, quote unquote, our robot saw you did this and this. Can you please tell us what you were thinking about? Can you tell
Ooh,
us
I
what
see.
happened
So
here? How did that work?
you might watch someone attempt to add an item to their bag and then stop. Another person attempt to add an item, and then you're realizing, okay, something here is broken because if they're trying to add it and they're not doing it, it's either the software doesn't let them or we're not making enough compelling enough for them to do it. Gotcha. And so you're watching them that way. For
We're
someone
watching
who
it all the time.
doesn't have a SAM, a partner who can build this quickly, if they wanted to be able to watch people, do you know software that lets them do that?
Sure. Well, you mentioned like KissMetrics, right? Google Analytics, Flurry. There's a whole bunch of tools out there that will give you the analytics. The problem is that what that gives you is the what. This is what is happening. And that's prone to a lot of interpretation. Right? So, okay, everybody stopped right here. Oh, I think that means X. No, I think that means Y. If you're an active user of your product, you have some sense of, okay, what could that actually mean? Because it might have happened to you before, right? You've
I
seen that
see.
issue. You're like, oh, I was confused by that too. Oh, I know what that is. If you still don't know, then you can go ask people, right? And in addition to this tracking thing, we had the feedback links and all that on the site. That gets used really, really rarely unless you're hyper focused on it. And a lot of times you lose the context with those sort of generic send us feedback links. So it's cool to have a send me feedback, but it's much cooler to see, oh, this person was at step 13 of step 15, right? And he seemed to enter data that said XYZ. Let's contact him for feedback versus generic guy sees box, enters whatever random comments he wants.
That's a good point.
All data is good data, right? You just have to know how to interpret it and how to work with it. And similarly, your own experiences using the product are data. And it's good data, but you have to know how to fold it into the bigger picture of what's going on.
Early on, you told Jeremy that you were told that you guys should probably be a content business, not a social network around gear, but a content business. What's the distinction, and why was that the approach you took?
Yeah, so we got some feedback from one of our early investors that what we should really be doing when we were talking about generating this content is go for deep, tangible, structured content, like right, stuff that's really meaty. So that it has long-lasting value, and we build up this sort of database of really accurate information about products. And that sort of led us down a path of where we had very structured information. We had a whole product database. We had attributes about each product. We merged duplicates of the products all the time, and we were building up a very structured, organized product database. And we, asked everybody to sort of help us build that as they were creating things, which was cool. So we sort of hit that, but the downside of that was the more structure and the more sort of depth and like quality, quote unquote, that you create with the content, the higher the bar to participation is, Right. So we would have people making very amazing things on Bagchat, but they would make like one a month.
Gotcha.
Right. And that fundamentally was a bit of a problem, right? Because especially in the early stages, you want people kind of interacting, whatever. But people would, we made it so like, how shall I say? So not, it's kind of epic, but like so important or so, you know, so like correct that people would spend like weeks thinking about what they were going to write in there. And we'd see them because we'd see them come in, do some edits, and then leave and see, come in, do some edits, leave. Right. So they're thinking about it really deeply, like writing a complex article or, you know, writing a book or whatever, which was great because the content that came out in many cases was amazing. But the quantity of that content was not nearly as amazing as if we had taken a much lighter weight approach to doing things.
I see. And so you decided to make it easier for people and less serious. And how do you do that? How do you communicate? Hey, you know what? You don't have to have your perfect gear here all assembled. You can just add your favorite pedal.
So we did that. So we said, okay, let's try totally the opposite for one time. And so we created a system where we had your email address. So we could basically go and see if you're on Flickr. And if you're on Flickr, you just hit a button. We'd go and pull your Flickr photo history. We'd go and look at the EXIF data, figure out what cameras, what lenses you used. We'd assemble a list of, okay, here's what we think your photo gear is. We think you have these and these camera bodies, these and these lenses. Oh, and by the way, we're going to include a picture that you took with each lens and with each camera body. And so, ta-da, here's your camera gear. So with like a minute, you could assemble your camera gear.
I
Super
see.
lightweight, super easy. And what we found with that was that the content ultimately sucked because people would go in there, they'd publish this thing, like, here's my gear. And they'd never say anything about it, right? It wasn't interesting. We didn't know why they chose the lenses. We didn't know what the combination of the lenses to the camera body meant for them. We didn't know when they used which camera body and which lens. So we didn't have that depth. And this was the constant trade-off, right? Like, you can make it super lightweight, hit a button, ta-da, here's your photo list. But like, you know, nobody cares once you've seen 10 of those or five of those even. Or we could make it, hey, it's really hard to get all this information in, but this thing that comes out is amazing and everybody loves it. And that was the tension. That was probably the biggest tension point of that company throughout its whole history, was this balance of lightweight participation versus depth of content. Because they were always sort of on a seesaw for us, right?
And I keep saying pedal, and you keep talking about camera equipment. Is that because you started to focus in on photographers?
Oh, no. It was just an easy thing that everybody groks. And
Gotcha.
with Flickr, we did the photography thing because, frankly, we could just build it with one click. There wasn't a similar thing for other kind of areas of interest.
Was it 8 months later that you guys sold to Twitter?
9 months after launching the product, we
How did
sold to
Twitter
Twitter.
approach you?
We had through one of our connections on the investor side. So one of our angel investors is actually on the board of Twitter.
Which one?
Peter Fenton.
Okay. How did they reach out to you?
We had been talking back and forth with them here and there, but I think Sam just started talking with Mike Abbott, who used to run engineering over there. And I don't think he's over there anymore. I think he's in EIR somewhere now.
So here's what I was getting at before we started this interview.
Yeah.
In the notes that Jeremy made on your pre-interview, we always ask guests, what was your lowest point? Because we don't want to just celebrate success. We want to understand how you got through the tough parts. And your lowest point, you said, was when we shut it down and sold it to Twitter. Why?
Well, it's twofold. One was, you know, at that point, we had built up a system and a way of working that allowed us to crank out lots of ideas quickly. And, you know, we had a flow. A lot of starting companies, as I've learned over the years, is getting all this stuff in place so that you can actually get going, right? I mean, there's so many things to do before you can actually start producing product. And, like, when you get to the point where you've got it, you have all these tools and you have your processes and you have your team and everything. It's like, that's the awesome state, right? And so that was kind of the state we were in. We had everything put together. We knew how to work together and we were liking, enjoying working together. So it was a real downer for me to sort of stop it around that phase. And I think that was probably, you know, like I enjoyed the job I had. I enjoyed working with the team. I enjoyed doing what I was doing. I enjoyed how I was doing it. And change in general is not great, right? But I think that was the thing that made it sort of, quote unquote, the mixed blessing for me, right? Obviously, we're thrilled to have, you know, the kind of outcome we had, but it was very bittersweet because we wouldn't be doing what we were loving to do anymore.
That's the other thing. You did say, hey, Andrew, don't make it out like this was a horrible situation. It was more of a gray area. Nothing's black and white.
Yeah.
So I understand the disappointment. What was the exciting part about selling to Twitter?
I think to step back half a second and talk about this, like when most people talk about startup acquisitions, they have this vision in their head of like, it's a pot of gold with a rainbow, right? And like everybody's dancing and there's unicorns around you and all this sort of stuff, right? I mean, it's just been very romanticized. And I think, you know, when you actually look at the realities of it, you're making choices like you are every day, day to day, right? Like, okay, we could keep going, but what does that mean? Oh, okay, well, what if we sell to this entity? What does that mean? What does the next couple of years look like? What happens to the product? And so there's all the stuff that you have to sort of weigh and make decisions on. And some of those are actually really, really big decisions that hit you kind of hard, right? You've made friends. You've got probably deeper than friends if it's like founders or co-founders or things like that. You know, so you've got like personal relationships in the game. You've got financial circumstances and the money. I mean, like, what are the things that are most stressful for people, right? Changing jobs, changing primary relationships, and changing homes. So if like any kind of thing like this, you've got at least two of those involved, right?
Right.
Money, jobs, and then, you know, personal relationships.
You started this company because you wanted to work with Sam. According to the TechCrunch article from the sale, Sam went on to Twitter. You did not.
Yep, that's right.
And so
So that's like, you know, you're breaking up. And your co-founder, after working together, we worked together for 18 months, plus if you count the time where, yeah, we worked together for many years, right? And like during the product, during the startup, I sat here, he sat there for 18 months. So you spend more time with that person than you end up spending with your actual wife or husband or whoever.
And this was an acqui-hire, wasn't it? Where they wanted the team. They wanted the minds, not necessarily to keep the site going.
The site's still up.
The site
but
is still
I can't,
up.
I can't comment on those sorts of things, but the site is still up and running. I still get notes and comments and interactions on there all the time.
But they weren't, Twitter did not want to get into the bag check business. They wanted to get into the Sam business.
I can't say that.
You can't say that. Okay.
No, that's a question for them. I would say the site's still up, and obviously they saw something of value to them at the time that made all this possible, and we're glad that we were able to give them something of value.
Okay. How did you guys do financially from the sale?
Still living.
Did you become a millionaire because of the sale?
I have not taken a salary for the past 3.5 years as I've been working on startups, right? So my philosophy when I left Yahoo and my philosophy from, you know, anything that happened with the Twitter thing is to sort of keep putting things away so that I can keep working on things that I'm passionate about. And, you know, it was part of the mixed blessing. I'm really fortunate that we had that, but, you know, part of the Twitter thing has kind of allowed me to keep going and doing things that I want to do. So
gotcha.
That's great.
Congratulations on that.
Thanks.
Let me see what else. You know, before we talk about the input factory, the other thing that you told Jeremy was that one of your challenges is that you have lots of different ideas. I hear this from people in the audience all the time. They will email me a list of really good ideas that they want to pursue, and that maybe they're pursuing one, but then they go to the other, and, you know, and then they pursue the other and they go to a third. How did you deal with that?
I think it's still a problem. I still have way too many ideas pop into my head. The bottom line is, you know, there's the idea and then there's everything else. And if you look at the amount of time that everything else eats up, you have to make a commitment, right? And the hard part, I think, is believing in the idea enough to make the kind of commitment you have to make. You know, we look at BackCheck, that was an 18-month commitment, right? If you look at my current startup right now, we sort of got going in March with the idea that we wanted to work together. We formalized it-ish in June-ish, July-ish, and now we're already in March, right? So having an idea is one thing, but then putting that commitment and that hard work behind the idea, that's a whole other ballgame.
And then once you go with one, do you cut off all the others?
No, you can always keep them on the back of your, keep them in the back of your mind, put them on the shelf, come back to them as appropriate, pull them out. Right. Regret ones that you didn't do, you should have done. I think it's very easy to say yes to things, especially today. Because, I mean, you can build whatever you want, especially in software, build whatever you want. It's very hard to say no to things because that means you've made an explicit decision and there's consequences to that decision. So most people have a hard time, including me. Absolutely. I have a hard time saying no to things as opposed to saying yes to things.
I do too. And I found, though, with ideas that if I'm working on one thing and then another idea comes up and I say, you know what, I'll work on it part-time just to see where it goes, basically the thing that I really care about, I'm not going to give enough attention to. And in fact, at the points where I'm feeling at the lowest, where I really have to push myself to continue and overcome an obstacle, that's when I say, hey, you know what? I have this other thing on the side. Let's go there. And so I don't push myself to overcome the obstacle. How do you deal with that?
I think it's all about making a commitment. So first of all, I'm terrible at making commitments. It took me a year to buy a couch. It takes me 6 months to decide which TV to buy.
Like, how long to decide to marry your wife?
About 4 years. 4 years. Probably.
That's not too bad.
Could have been 4 years of thinking, should I do it?
You knew before then.
We've been together longer than that. But yeah, so, you know, I'm not
so
a
how
very
do you get yourself to make a commitment then when you're commitment phobic?
I got to be pushed. I have to, at some point I just do it and I become very, very comfortable with it, but it takes me a really long time to get to that point. And I probably try every single way to get out of it before I ever make that commitment.
Can you give me an example?
I'll just look at every single way I can possibly hedge my bets before I jump in, right? So if the current company, like, we bootstrapped the whole thing for many months. And then when we couldn't do all the work that we needed to do between the two of us, we started hiring people ad hoc. And then instead of, you know, going and raising money, we're like, okay, we'll just pay this out of our pockets for a while. Oh, maybe we can just do like a really, really small, tiny, tiny seed round just to go for a couple months. And we looked at like all the different ways to hedge our bets before we were 100% sure we wanted to make that commitment.
I see. To say, hey, we're fully in here. It's okay to hire someone. It's okay to raise a little money.
Well, I think when you hire and when you, you know, raise round, those are pretty big commitments, right? Because you're sort of diving deep into it. So with me, it was like every way we could not make that decision, we did, until you hit a point where, look, you gotta either jump or
get on board. Totally different from how I would do it and other entrepreneurs who I interviewed here on Mixergy, but it seems to work. You're saying, hey, you continue with it until it's so real that you have to commit to it.
And if
Or not. And if it's not at that point, then you know what? Then the world has made the decision for you, or the business has made the decision for you. It's not strong enough. It's not mature enough to survive on the little attention that I'm giving it. So why give it even more?
Yeah. And, you know, it's actually a blessing if you find out it's not going to work or it is going to work. Most things end up in the middle ground, right? Oh, it might work. Oh, it could work if we do this. You know, that's sort of that's the thing I'm most scared of personally. I'm most frightened of being in this middle state where we're like, oh, what if we did this? Oh, maybe, you know, and just that can suck you up for years.
How'd you get the idea for the Input Factory?
So the idea for the company came from me and my co-founder again. So like I guess I'm turning this into a pattern, but I try to find someone that I want to work with and has a complementary skill set to what I'm doing. Right. So with the Input Factory, my co-founder is Jeff Cole. We worked together 8 years ago or so on a company called Patients Like Me that he was a founder of. It was very early sort of Web 2.0 meets health. And as Jeff and his other co-founders like to say, they spent most of their early budget on me doing conceptual designs for them. So he ran that company 8 years. He was there. And then 8 years later, we sort of reconnected again and decided we wanted to try something different. And when we did that, you know, like his background at Patients Like Me was founding the company, building the engineering team, but also starting the data analytics group, which looked at all the stuff that people were sharing on that site and tried to find patterns and insights and things like this. And my background is mobile plus design plus input. And so what we sort of gravitated around through a similar process that me and Sam went through, where we iterate back and forth, talk about ideas. We sort of blended in this space of, well, let's see if there's something we can do where we can get really lightweight engagement on mobile, like input, and turn that into data that we can then analyze on the back end to create something interesting. So that's our big vision thing, similar to our big vision over at Bagcheck was, hey, e-commerce is due for a shakeup with the advent of some of the things that have changed the web over the past 10, 12 years.
Okay, so I give you just a little bit of information, like answer a couple of questions, do I prefer this or that, and then you give me something meaningful in return.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, the first product we put out under this big picture thesis is called Polar, and Polar, again, now we go into like, you know, what's the real world insight that's actually generating a product from this, and what we have there is everybody's got an opinion. You have an opinion. I have an opinion. We're talking about our opinions right now, right? Whether or not you even want my opinion, sometimes I'm going to give it to you. But the means for collecting opinions on the internet and in software engineering are just abysmal, right? Like you think about your typical survey form or feedback form or any way you try and collect information from people. It's a 5-page form fill. It's got like these checkboxes, these radio buttons, and they're so crappy that companies and organizations are paying people to take them, right? Here's $25 if you take this survey. And even then, they have like 0.1% participation rate. So it's just horrendously broken. But at the same time, everybody wants opinions, everybody collects opinions, everybody shares opinions. So we said, well, let's see if we can sort of take our big principle and apply it to this area. And what we tried to do is just invert that whole system, make it from so painful that nobody does it to make it so fun that people want to do it and spend lots of time doing it and actually enjoy doing it. And that's kind of what the whole first product about is can we change that dynamic and turn opinion collection and sharing into something fun and engaging versus something crappy and avoid at all costs.
I wanted to use an expression that you use to describe the input factory, that it's a mullet. And you said, hey, let's just describe what the business is before we use this
Sure.
tweet that I sent out to explain it. Why did you call it a mullet in one of your tweets?
Yeah, so this relates to sort of the big picture idea, right? I called it the tech mullet. And what I said there is it's small, mobile, sort of micro interactions up front and big data in the back. That is, people got these mobile devices with them anywhere and everywhere. They're pulling them out for a minute here or a minute there. They're pulling out, everywhere and anywhere that you can be online, you're online now. So you have this opportunity to collect lots and lots of small bits of information from people. And then there's also this big trend for big data, which is let's get tons and tons of information and let's mine it for interesting insights and things like this. So that's sort of what I call the mullet, because it's kind of the opposite, right? The thing you're doing up front on mobile with that client, it's all about small, tiny, very quick and easy. But what you're doing on the back end is like giant, big, complex, figure things out. Which isn't exactly like a mullet, but it's, sort of those two opposites together in one.
All right, let me do a quick plug here, and then I want to ask you a question about this one sentence that you happened to say to Jeremy that I think is really important to talk about. And one fine, actually two things, that, and then I also want to ask you about the surprising thing that I saw about the Input Factory. But first, to everyone who's listening, if you're not a premium member, go to mixergypremium.com right now. And well, in the interviews, what we do is we tell the stories of entrepreneurs and how they built their businesses. One of the things that people love about Mixergy Premium is I invite entrepreneurs to come back and teach what they are good at and show you how they do it. If they're good at getting traffic and you have an issue getting traffic, I ask them to turn their monitors on and just show step by step what they do to get traffic. If they're good at monetizing that traffic, I ask them to walk me through that process step by step to show me how they do it. One of my favorite courses that I don't think enough people are taking is the one with Juan Martitegui. He is the guy who works for Mindvalley, the Hispanic version of it. And he shows how he structures his business, how he structures the funnel of his business, and then what he does to improve it 10% each time. And he says, look, with compounding interest, if all you get is a 10% increase this week and then another 10% on top of that next week and so on and so forth, the business grows. And he showed his revenues to show how big the business can grow and what he did to get it there. If you are struggling with your process, with organizing your business into a funnel that makes sense and delivers customers to the end, that's one course I highly recommend. Take Juan's course, mixergypremium.com. I guarantee it. All right. Now that the plug is in there, and I'm really hoping that people go and check it out, and I see that they keep going back to it, and I appreciate it, guys. By the way, in addition to getting all this for yourself, you also help fund the editing that we do on these interviews, the research, and so on. So thank you to all you Mixergy Premium members. Here's the thing that I noticed. You had a business coach at Yahoo. What did the business coach help you do back when Yahoo was going through layoffs?
So when I said business coach, essentially it was executive training, right? And they put me through a rigor of personality tests and sort of, and what I came out of, I came out with like two binders this big about me. And the most useful thing to me was I realized what I don't want to do. What I shouldn't be doing, right? There's two schools. There's like, here's your strengths, go build on them. And then here's your strengths, here's the things you got to go work on. I sort of firmly fell in the camp of here's your strengths, go crank on them, and then fill in the gaps so that you can work more on your strengths as opposed to spend all your time filling out the gaps. And so what that process oriented me towards was, I like to make products, I like to ship things, and I like to do it quick, and I hate not seeing things come out. So hence startup life.
I see. And if someone wanted to go and take that kind of strength finder test to know what their strengths are, what do you recommend? Is it strength finder, the process based on the book, or is there something else?
One of the most complete ones we took was one that the actual military uses. I think it's called like the Hogan Performance Assessment Tests. I don't
Okay.
know if those are available online, or I think it's called the Hogan thing. We took like five or six of these different tests, but the one that was sort of most complete and interesting to me was the one where they put military commanders through it to see like how you're going to react if someone's doing whatever, right?
Gotcha.
That was kind of cool.
All right. Finally, I was going to tell people to go check out your website, The Input Factory, but I believe before I started this interview, when I went over to the site, it wasn't up. Is there a site for The Input Factory?
There's no site for Input Factory. The Polar Bee, as in polarbee.com, that's where you can find info about the app. But there's no like corporate site or anything
And if
like
someone
that.
wants to connect with you and say, "Hey, I really like your idea. I want to apply to work for you or something."
Emails on the bottom. A little contact us link.
Email right on the bottom of polarbee.com. Sorry?
Yeah, no,
Oh,
that's
okay.
right.
I thought maybe I had it completely wrong.
No, you got it.
All right, Luke, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you all for being a part of it. Oh, you know what? One more thing to the editor. Keep this in. I keep hearing about people who are other entrepreneurs who are listening to these interviews, who connect with the guests, and somehow they end up doing business. This feels like now a business development show. People watch these interviews and then they end up with biz development opportunities. Almost always, it starts off with the person who's listening saying thank you to the guest. That's why I always do it. That's why I always urge you guys to do it. That's why I try to find an email address for you guys if you're listening to do it. Find that email address, send Luke an email, say thank you if you got anything of value out of this, and maybe some business relationship will come out of it down the road, but definitely something good will happen. Try it, you'll see. Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, guys.